Well, hello everyone. David Hunter here from the Scottish Studies Foundation, and a very warm welcome to you all. Thank you for your company today for this, the third in our 2022-2023 series of Scottish Studies Zoom talks. Since the pandemic, these talks have been replacing the monthly in-person talks that we used to hold in Toronto. As these talks have proved extremely popular, it's our plan to continue with them. And of course, as we see today, we are now able to engage with people no matter where they are on the face of the planet. Our guest speaker today is Andrew Jones, who joins us from Marietta, which is a town near Reinhardt University in Atlanta, Georgia, where he is currently a postdoctoral teaching historian. Andrew completed his PhD at the University of Edinburgh in 2018, and his research focuses on religion, identity, and race in modern Scotland and in the Scottish diaspora. His talk today will be based on his recent book, The Revival of Evangelicalism, Mission and Piety in the Victorian Church of Scotland. So, Andrew, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. Now, you're from the United States, so what motivated you to study in Scotland?
That's a great question. First of all, thank you so much, David, for having me. It's wonderful to be here, and I'm looking forward to being able to present my research and to meet some of you for the questions as well. The interest for me was born out of genealogical interest. Like many Americans and many Canadians, I have Scottish ancestry. So knowing that growing up kind of gave me an interest in Scottish history. So as a teenager, when I got a chance to do papers and essays in school, I tended to focus on Scottish themes and Scottish history, and then had the opportunity in university to spend a term at the University of St. Andrews in Fife, and then later on had the opportunity to return to Scotland for my PhD at the University of Edinburgh. So it began as kind of an interest, and then snowballed into a passion, a vocation, and a career.
I'm really looking forward to your talk. I'm finding that these talks trigger an awareness, for me anyway, an awareness of issues that I would not otherwise have paid much attention to. A case in point was last Saturday when I saw the new King Charles III on TV performing his very first act as a king. By law, he had to sign a historic oath to uphold the Presbyterian system of church governance in Scotland, a throwback to the 1707 Act of Union between England and Scotland. The relevance of this would probably have escaped me had I not been thinking about your talk today. So, Andrew, the floor is yours.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. This presentation, my talk, should be about 30 minutes. And after that, I'd love to field some questions and to hear your feedback. So, my talk is labeled The Revival of Evangelicalism, Mission and Piety in the Victorian Church of Scotland, which is also conveniently the title of my book. Now, my book was published in March of this year with Edinburgh University Press. The book was the result of my doctoral research, plus several years of editing, kind of reshaping, and the like. So what I'm going to do is present kind of three different slides, and in these slides, talk about the book, both in terms of its context, in terms of its content, and in terms of its applicability, especially for people living in modern Canada. So to start with, let's take a look at the first slide. The first slide is evangelicalism and Scottish evangelicalism. Now, many of us probably have heard the term evangelical on the news, perhaps, in reference to voting blocs in American politics. The term evangelical means everything and nothing in 2022, but it has a really distinct theological, social, and cultural identity in terms of a Protestant movement going back into the 18th century. So what is evangelicalism? Evangelicalism is a transatlantic, transdenominational, global Protestant movement that originated in the 18th century with the transatlantic Protestant awakenings that took place in places like Scotland, Wales, Massachusetts, and Virginia in the 1730s and the 1740s. Some figures we associate with these early evangelical revivals are people like Charles Wesley, Jonathan Edwards, and George Whitfield. The Atlantic Protestant Awakening movement that eventually became what we call evangelicalism continued on into the latter part of the 18th century, through the 19th century, through the 20th century, and on to the present. But what gave this movement cohesion is a big question historians have been asking for the last 30 years as interest in evangelicalism has risen in light of the prominence of evangelicals in American Atlantic world life. The historian, to provide the most kind of widely accepted definition of evangelicalism or evangelicals, is actually an historian who taught for his entire career at the University of Stirling named David Bebbington. According to David Bebbington, an evangelical is somebody who shares four distinct characteristics, and thus this definition has become known as the Bebbington Quadrilateral. So according to David Bebbington, an evangelical is a Protestant, a Christian, who believes in conversion, who believes that Christians experience some kind of spiritual awakening that takes them from no faith to faith, death to life, language like this. So conversionism, or belief in a distinct conversion experience, is a defining feature of evangelicalism. A second feature is crucicentrism. This is actually a word that Bebbington essentially made up to explain the idea that the cross of Christ, is central to evangelical theology. So crucicentrism is people believing that the cross of Christ is the locus of human salvation in the biblical story of redemption. So evangelicals are conversionist, they're crucicentrist. Third, they're biblicist. Going back all the way, of course, into the 18th century, evangelicals have been people who take the Bible seriously, both as a useful tool for personal devotion and as an authority to guide their theology and to guide their thinking about Christianity. So evangelicals, now with three, we have our conversionists, crucicentrists, biblicists. And the third thing that Bebbington kind of isolates as he studies evangelicals across time and space is that evangelicals are activists. Many evangelicals turn their faith, turn their spiritual zeal into both social and spiritual activity. So a social activism might be abolitionism. Many of us are well aware of the fact that the British slave trade came to an end thanks to the work of the evangelical William Wilberforce. In terms of spiritual activism, we see this taking place in the modern missionary movement. The idea of sending missionaries from Europe and from North America to the global south, to what we used to refer to as the third world, this impetus on evangelism, world missions, is also a touchstone of evangelical activism. So an evangelical is a conversionist, a crucicentrist, a biblicist, and an activist. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about evangelicalism as a movement across space and time. Now, what makes evangelicalism distinct in Scotland? A few things. David Bebbington himself, having taught in Scotland for his entire academic career, wrote a few other pieces about Scottish evangelicalism in particular, and noted a few distinct characteristics. Evangelicals in Scotland, unsurprisingly, tend to be Calvinist in their theology, over and against the Arminian theology of the Wesleyans, of the Methodists. Evangelicals in Scotland also tend to emphasize education as a tool of evangelization and as a tool of social good more than evangelicals in other parts of the Atlantic world. So Calvinism and education are two kind of key components of evangelicalism in Scotland that are more emphasized than elsewhere. Now, in terms of Scottish evangelicalism in the Church of Scotland, in the established church, we see the movement begin to make an impact starting in the early years of the movement in the 1730s and the 1740s. In the early 1740s, many of you might know, there was an awakening movement that took place in the southwest of Scotland, especially in two parishes called Cambuslang and Kilsyth. The revival movements in Cambuslang from Kilsyth were directly related to the movements going on in Massachusetts, where Jonathan Edwards, the American evangelical, was leading revivals in Northampton. The ministers in Scotland, like Erskine and McLaren and James Robe, these people who are leading these revivals, are corresponding via epistolary networks with evangelicals in Wales, in Massachusetts, and in England. So this is a network movement from the beginning. Nevertheless, evangelicalism for the first 60 years of its existence in Scotland as a distinct movement is a minority movement. The Church of Scotland is, during this time, not necessarily an evangelical denomination, but welcomes evangelical voices. This changes, however, in the 1790s. In the 1790s, we see a renewed emphasis on evangelicalism from more and more ministers in the established church, in the national or the established Church of Scotland. This leads to popularity as evangelicals come to take on prominent roles in the church. The most famous, most prominent evangelical from this period between the 1790s and 1830s is most likely Thomas Chalmers. So evangelicals become popular and become leaders in the national or the established Church of Scotland. At the same time, during this period, evangelicalism becomes somewhat politicized and the church itself is going to become more politicized as well. So during the 1790s to 1830s, we see two distinct parties or two distinct groups emerging in the established Church of Scotland. One is led by evangelicals. The other is led by a group of people called moderates. Evangelicals tend to emphasize spiritual vitality, these theological emphases. Moderates tend to be more guided by rational enlightenment thought and view evangelicalism as overly zealous or overly fanatical. So things come to a head over one major issue, and that issue is church patronage. Going back all the way into the early 18th century, one of the stipulations of reestablishing Presbyterianism was giving the landed heritors, usually aristocrats or gentry, the ability to nominate ministers for a local parish. This practice is called patronage. Now, practicing patronage became a problem for evangelicals because they wanted their own congregations to have the ability to vote upon the candidate they believed would preach the most evangelical sermon on a given Sunday morning. So when a minister who was not an evangelical was nominated by the patron and put in the church, evangelicals called this intrusion. They believed that their rights as church members were being intruded upon by the gentry and supported by the state. And this crisis led to a conflict that took place between 1830 and 1843 called the 10 Years Conflict. During the 10 Years Conflict, these partisan disputes between the evangelical party and the moderate party became much more heated over this issue of patronage. The evangelicals finally, once the issue of patronage was declared in favor of the moderates by the Court of Session and eventually by the House of Lords, the evangelicals decided that their future could no longer remain in the national or established church. So, in a very kind of cataclysmic event, and on May 18th, 1843, about one third of the ministers and eventually about one half of the parishioners or laity in the established Church of Scotland seceded or left the Church of Scotland to form a church called the Free Church, the Free Church of Scotland, a church free from government intrusion, from patronage, and the like. So that's where my story picks up. That's all context, all background for what I'm talking about in my book. My book is focusing on what happens to evangelicalism as a movement and evangelical preachers who decide to remain in the established church during and after the disruption. So that takes us to our second slide. And this is where I'll just give you a little bit of a rundown, a little bit of an introduction to my book. So the origins of the book came actually from my master's dissertation, which looked at a revival, an evangelical revival that took place on the island of St. Kilda in the early 1840s. As most of you know, St. Kilda is a really remote community in the Outer Hebrides off the coast of the Isle of Harris. And the community there was small, and the community was supplied occasionally by ministers from the Church of Scotland. And one of those ministers who arrived in the 1830s was called Neil Mackenzie. Mackenzie arrived. Mackenzie wasn't evangelical. He subscribed to evangelical periodicals. He preached evangelical sermons. By all accounts, his CV lined up with this Bebbington quadrilateral, this idea of what an evangelical was. Nevertheless, when the disruption happened, something I found odd was that Neil Mackenzie did not leave the Church of Scotland. Neil Mackenzie stayed in the Church of Scotland. So that got me asking, were there others? Could there be other evangelicals who did not secede with the majority of evangelicals, but rather remain inside the established church for the duration of the 19th century? So that was my main questions. My research questions essentially were about continuity, breadth, and impact. First of all, to what extent did the evangelical movement from the 1790s to the 1830s continue to exert influence inside the established church? The second question was breadth. To what extent did evangelical thinking and evangelical theology broaden or liberalize in this period in the established church as it dealt with shifts in culture and society? And the final question was impact. What impact, if any, did evangelical preaching and evangelical ministers have on the established church from 1843, from the disruption, until 1900, until the end of the century? The methodologies that I used to look at these questions were looking at people and looking at periodicals. So I focused on three ministers in the Church of Scotland: William Muir, Norman MacLeod, and Archibald Hamilton Charteris, who preached and lived roughly during kind of 25 to 30 year periods from 1843 to 1900. And then along with these ministers, this biographical approach, I also took a textual analysis approach and wanted to look at the things being published and printed by evangelicals in the established church during this period. And for that purpose, from 1843 to 60, I focused on the missionary record of the Church of Scotland, or the mission record. From 1860 to 72, I focused on a periodical called Good Words, which is published by Norman MacLeod. And from the final period, from 1879 to 1900, I focused on a Church of Scotland magazine called Life and Work Magazine. It's still in around, still existence today. It was started by Archibald Hamilton Charteris. So my thesis, my finding, the overall argument is as follows, and this is a direct quote from the book. I say, this book explores the extraordinary resurgence of the National Church of Scotland in the decades after the disruption, and argues that gifted and committed evangelical leaders played a critical role in the processes of revitalization. So the evangelicals remain in the church. The evangelicals help the established church recover after the losses from the disruption, and help to revitalize and re-energize the missions of the church as a whole. So William Muir, first figure, the first chapter is on William Muir. He was a member of the Middle Party. This very interesting group of people called the Middle Party were explicitly evangelical ministers, but were explicitly against secession. So this is the core group of evangelicals who stay in the church, but are also committed to evangelical principles. And William Muir is a leader amongst those figures. The mission record, I'll say more about this in a second in relation to Canada, is basically going to record the goings-on of the missionary agencies of the church, which for the most part are led by evangelicals. So by studying the mission record, we see what's going on institutionally and in terms of lay support during this period. Norman MacLeod, who was born in the Isle of Skye and raised the middle part of, you know, the central belt, and then eventually becomes a pastor, a minister in Glasgow. William Muir is the figure I focus on in relation to breadth. Norman MacLeod is going to be more innovative theologically. And through the influence of Norman MacLeod, we're going to see evangelical theology actually broaden or liberalize from a more rigorous Calvinism to a more open or moderate Calvinism between the 1870s and the 1890s, especially in relation to themes like eternal future punishment or hell, and themes like limited atonement or salvation, and things of this nature. And we see these things, again, mirrored broadly in the theological writings and the churchly musings from the magazine Good Words during a roughly contiguous period. Finally, for impact, I looked at Archibald Hamilton or A.H. Charteris. Charteris was a professor of biblical studies at the University of Edinburgh, but also an ardent supporter of lay democratization, of lay movements in the church. It was Charteris, along with Charteris's wife, Katie, who helped start the deaconess movement in the Church of Scotland, which eventually would lay the groundwork for female ordination. It was also Charteris who helped establish the Young Men's Guild, essentially the Boys' Brigade in the Church of Scotland, the Women's Guild, Missions Guilds, all kinds of local lay organizations to diffuse the energy of evangelicalism in the pews and also outside the doors of the church. Charteris also was a supporter of revivalism. Some of us may have heard of the famous American revivalist Dwight Moody. Dwight Moody came to Edinburgh in the 1870s, and it was through the work of Charteris that Moody gained a hearing and that the church's doors opened to the American revival message. So Charteris was deeply involved in this, and Life and Work magazine, again, from this period over 21, 22 years, shows that in greater detail we couldn't see when we just look at the biography of Charteris. So that's the structure, methodology, and the argument of the book. And it was a joy to research and write. I really enjoyed my time in Edinburgh. And since then, final thing I'd like to do and share with you, I'll say y'all, I do live in Georgia. So the final thing I'd like to share with y'all for this morning is a little bit about connecting some things where many of you might live or have familiarity, and that is, of course, in Eastern Canada. So transatlantic connections established evangelicals in Canada. So the missionary schemes of the Church of Scotland, the mission record, this magazine that I focused on from 1843 to 1860, highlighted the six committees or schemes that the Church of Scotland focused on during the 19th century. And that was the education scheme, the foreign mission scheme, the Jewish mission scheme, home missions, church endowment, and colonial churches. And the thing that has the most direct impact for Canada was the Committee for Colonial Churches. The Committee for Colonial Churches was established by the General Assembly of the Established Church in the 1830s, and was strong and up and running by the time of the disruption. Nevertheless, there was an impact felt during the disruption. I have a quote here from the book, and this is something from the mission record from November, so a few months after the disruption. This is about the nature of Presbyterian or Church of Scotland allegiance in Canada. So the author writes this: "The great body of our American congregations, with their ministers, it is believed, will remain true to the church of their fathers. Such fidelity should entitle them to a place in our high esteem and to such support as we can render them." So many of the Church of Scotland churches that had been established by the colonial committee in places like Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and Newfoundland, these places are going to remain dedicated to or faithful to the established church rather than joining the free church. In light of this, the committee is going to send four separate deputations or groups of ministers to this part of what is now Canada during the 1840s and 50s. And it's really interesting to see the focus and the geographical and the linguistic focus of these deputations. So geographically, most of these deputations focus on Nova Scotia and Prince Edward Island, and almost all of them include at least one Gaelic-speaking minister because of the kind of ubiquity of Gaelic speakers in these parts of Canada due to the nature of mid-century immigration. So the minister who went across first was Norman MacLeod. Both the one we talked about earlier and his father, who was a famous Gaelic preacher in Glasgow. The second figure who went across was a man named Simon McIntosh to preach in Gaelic to the Canadian diaspora. The third was William Sutherland, and the fourth was a man named Alexander Matheson. And these four deputations were essentially kind of stopgap measures, because one thing that happened after disruption is that many Church of Scotland ministers who were in Canada were called back to fill pulpits that had been abandoned by ministers who had joined the Free Church. So the deputations was kind of the first attempt to provide ministerial provision for Church of Scotland parishes that were kind of governed by the Colonial Committee in modern day Canada. Over time, we see increased full-time ministerial provision. During the 1840s, it's mostly a period of recovery. Again, the disruption has an impact. And to make matters worse, during this period, even more and more Scots, especially from the Gaeltacht, are moving over to these parts of Canada. So less preachers and more people is more pressure for ministerial provision. But in the 1850s, this pressure is relieved, because we see more and more and more young, recently ordained Church of Scotland ministers volunteering to go to Canada to become ministers in these parishes who are desperate for Gaelic preachers. So we see renewed enthusiasm and increased provision starting in the 1850s and continuing to the 1860s. The final thing I'll say is unintended consequences. So this, of course, has somewhat of a, it's kind of a double-edged sword for the Church of Scotland. During this period, we begin to see an awareness amongst the Canadian Presbyterians that there is a need for local mobilization. The Mother Church in Edinburgh cannot provide all their needs. There needs to be something on the ground in terms of local mobilization. And for this, we see the establishment of lay societies. We see the establishment of Queen's in Ontario as a training college for ministers. So over time, that actually relieves the pressure on the Church of Scotland, but it's also a double-edged sword or kind of an unintended consequence, because over time, the ties that the churches had to Edinburgh, Glasgow, Inverness, to their family members, to the institution of the Church of Scotland, these ties begin to loosen such that eventually the four major Scottish Presbyterian groups or denominations in Canada come together and establish the Presbyterian Church of Canada, an independent church, in 1875. So that's a little bit of, again, connective tissue, drawing together some themes, some topics from the book, but also that relate to life in Canada in the 19th century. That's all I have. Thank you for listening. Thank you for allowing me to share my research and share my book with you all. And I really look forward to any discussion or questions that we can have over the next few minutes. Thank you so much.
Do we have any questions at the moment? Okay, question from Donald Gillis. Donald, nice to see you, Donald. Timothy Hashevain.
Dr. Jones, thank you very much for your very enlightening talk. Now, I'm particularly interested in your references to Gaelic, to use the English word, or Gaelic, to use the Gaelic word. I first came across the, should we say, separation between the Church of Scotland and a variety of Free Church in the village of Broadford in Skye, where I was born about 70 years ago. Now, you mentioned St. Kilda, and of course, St. Kilda was entirely Gaelic-speaking at that time. If today you travel around the Western Isles, especially the island of Lewis, as you may well have done, as many of us here may have done, you see a variety of churches, the Church of Scotland, but also what I would call a variety of Free Churches. I don't know about the casual phrase, We Frees, and also the Free Church of Scotland established. So the question that I'm getting to is this: to what extent is the fractionating of the Church of Scotland in the Western Isles a significant part of what you talked to us about, and why does it seem to continue? Thank you.
That's a great question. Thank you so much, Mr. Gillis. I love it to be born in Broadford. I'm sure it was a lovely place to grow up. My wife and I spent a week on Skye. She was indulgent. Let me trundle around cemeteries looking for dead ministers, and we also had some time to do some sightseeing as well. So the thing about the Free Church that's interesting and that relates to my project is that the irony is that the Free Church, people tended to think in the mid-19th century that the Free Church was more conservative and more Calvinist, and the established church was more liberal. One thing that my book talks about is that in reality, there were Calvinist and progressive elements in both churches. So the Free Church, which existed between 1843 and 1900, when it joined with the United Presbyterian Church to become the United Free Church, the Free Church that existed for the first 57 years, it also evolved theologically and evolved in a way that made it more kind of culturally adaptive, similar to what was happening in the Church of Scotland. And that's what led to the fracturing at the turn of the century. So the first fracturing, or one of the first fracturings in the Free Church happened in 1900, when most of the Free Church joined with the United Presbyterian Church, or the old dissenters, and they formed the UFC, the United Free Church, but there was a small fraction who stayed out. And that is the ancestors of the modern Free Church of Scotland. Then there were other fractions in the 20th century that led to the Free Church continuing. And the Free Church continuing is another one of those small Free Churches. And then, of course, there are a few other, the Free Presbyterian Church, I think, is an example. I believe there was one of those in Edinburgh that I walked past a few times. So a lot of the splintering in the Free Church and in the kind of the hyper-Calvinist, kind of Gaelic-speaking parts of Scotland, a lot of that comes originally from doctrinal disputes, but over time, a lot of it also involves politics. It involves people, it involves personalities. So in the end, the distance theologically between the Free Church today, the Free Church continuing today, and the Reformed Presbyterian Church, it's very minor, especially when compared to the established church. But all of these things are born of both kind of general theological dispute and oftentimes local or kind of regional disputes as well. Now, the term evangelical is interesting. There's a professor named Donald MacLeod who taught at the Free Church College on the Mound for many years. And he was famous for telling his students that, you know, we in the Free Church are not evangelical because we don't believe in conversion, because, you know, more kind of traditional Presbyterians tend to think of coming to faith as a less experiential event and as a more kind of personal, how do you say, kind of a developmental event. So there's some discrepancy in terms of people who describe themselves as evangelicals and people who fit into the kind of scholarly paradigm of what makes an evangelical. So there are these kind of, you know, there are these nuances that can be made as well. But it is interesting, and you're right. You know, one thing you see, the irony is that there are parts of Edinburgh or in Glasgow that are essentially churchless. And you drive through a wee village in Harris, and there are five churches. So it's interesting to think about that in terms of kind of modern and historical context. So thank you so much. Does that answer your question at all?
Thank you, Dr. Jones. And the notion of finding five churches in the small village is something that I have noticed in Lewis in particular, but perhaps in Harris as well. Again, thank you so much.
If you have a question, please unmute yourself and ask the question. Okay, well, as it happens, I have some questions because some people send me some questions beforehand. Unfortunately, they're unable to attend, but hopefully they'll be able to get the recording. And of course, as they haven't heard your talk, maybe some of these questions you have already answered. So the first one is from Margaret Thomas in Port Hope, Ontario. And she says, what impact, if any, did the disruption have on any other denominations? For example, the Baptists, Methodists, Congregationalists, etc. Did people move from the Church of Scotland to these other denominations?
That's a great question. The short answer is, I don't know. The long answer is mostly no. So in my research, I've never seen somebody go usually from Congregational to Presbyterian. Nevertheless, I often see it go the other way. So there are several ministers that appear in my book that are actually were trained in Congregational, very occasionally Baptist seminaries or kind of Bible schools, and then eventually leave that denomination, leave that tradition, and become ordained in Presbyterian traditions, either free church or established church. So I often see it go the other way, but I rarely in my research have seen somebody leave Presbyterianism to join either Congregationalism or a Baptist community.
Okay, the next question comes from Elizabeth McDonald, who's in Thunder Bay, Ontario. And she says, what part did women play in the disruption?
That's a great question. It's a story that needs to be better told, but unfortunately, due to the nature of society and the patriarchal nature of especially church institutions in this period, the female voice is very muted in terms of the disruption. We do know that a lot of women's societies were established. We know that women were instrumental in a lot of the mission agencies. Women played a larger role in the established church than the free church, because attitudes towards kind of moving beyond the cult of domesticity, moving beyond these things, were more accepted in the established church than the free church. So over time, women like Katie Charteris were able to be set apart as deaconesses. There was no ordination yet, but we have this language of being set apart, which is a forerunner for female ordination. As far as the disruption goes, though, women's role, you know, as far as the records show, was mostly that of a support role, helping to lead fundraising efforts and, to be quite frank, just kind of supporting the male ministry.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. If anyone has a question, just feel free to unmute yourself.
I think Catherine has a question.
Thank you very much. I'm going to say good afternoon because I'm in Scotland. Just outside Dunfermline. Dr. Jones, I've done some research into the disruption, particularly in relation to St. Andrews and Dunfermline. Yeah. What my interest was having read quite a bit, I formed the thesis that the free church was of more interest to the working class than to the, shall we say, academic class. So the research that I started started with suggesting that St. Andrews would not be interested in the free church, and Dunfermline would be, because Dunfermline, and again, I've researched there, was very much an industrial town. In the end, I wasn't able to prove my thesis. and one of the things that caught me short was, I don't know if you know this, Dr. Jones, but David Brewster, who was the principal of St. Andrews at the time, was a staunch free church man. And indeed, very nearly lost his job over it. And the other thing that was quite interesting of the two towns is that an historian in Dunfermline, Peter Chalmers, was the first minister of the Dunfermline Abbey Church. They had two ministers. He was the first minister, and he moved to the Free Church. And once the new Free Church was built, he moved back to the established church. And from then on, spoke about the established church. But my question, and I know it's a little bit away from what you were saying, was, did you come across anything in the disruption where you might have thought that it was the working class that favored the free church?
I didn't do as much social history as you did. I'd be fascinated to hear more about that, partially because there was a scholar in the 1980s, a Marxist scholar. What was his name? It was Max something, and he wrote his dissertation, his thesis, and eventually published a book about this very topic, about class and disruption and class in relation to the free church. And I think what he found, and it's interesting that this might differ from what you found, and that may be a geographical difference, what he found is that the free church, in fact, wasn't really interested at all in reaching out to the working class, and that they were much more interested in kind of maintaining a middle-class, respectable identity. So one thing that I found, just kind of very cursorily, was that during the early period, the Free Church may have kind of, due to just the energy, the vitality of the movement, attracted some working-class members. But partially because the Free Church was a voluntary church. All money was raised by themselves. They didn't have as much money to disperse amongst the poor or as much money to support agencies and missions for the poor. During that same period, and again, due to some prominent evangelicals, like a man named William Robertson in the Grassmarket in Edinburgh, we do see Church of Scotland evangelicals honing in on the working classes and establishing working class missions, partially because, again, it being an established church, the ministers in the established church viewed their mission macrocosmically as being any human soul inside their parish, right? Because the parish structure meant that technically, you know, anybody who lived in, you know, the parish of Leith or North Leith was under your care. So the working classes, the middle classes, and the upper classes. Now, the upper classes tended to be Episcopalian. The lower classes tended to be dissenters. But even yet, there was still a focus on reaching the working classes more in the established church, at least in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, than there was in the Free Church. Now, this, of course, gets intertwined with evangelical foci that may have differed from the focuses or the priorities of the poor. So one of the things we see in this period are temperance campaigns, campaigns against various vices. And these are evangelical campaigns focused on the working classes, but not necessarily on their betterment, more on their respectability, if that makes sense. So I don't know, does that answer your question a bit?
Thank you very much, thank you.
Any more questions from the floor? Donald Gillis, again, you'll have to unmute yourself.
Dr. Jones, I think of Scotland as a very sectarian country, despite the changes that have occurred. For instance, I was amazed to see the Roman Catholic Archbishop of St. Andrews in Edinburgh participating in the memorial service for the late Queen in St. Giles Cathedral last week. Now, my father's family were Roman Catholics. I had an uncle who was a Catholic priest in South Uist. And in Eriski, where actually I was baptized. My mother took us across the Minch in the dead of winter, and I was baptized there. My Presbyterian grandfather thought there was no luck in the family after the Catholics came into it. Now, that's sort of a sectarian point of view, but what I'm getting to is this. How did the Roman Catholic Church, which had been, of course, in dire straits for a very long time, until about 1827, when that act occurred. How was the Roman Catholic Church dealt with in this whole period? And maybe the other way around, how did the Roman Catholic Church react to this evangelicism and the whole disruption? Is there anything in that area you could tell us about?
I can't speak necessarily to the Catholic point of view, what's going on in terms of the kind of diocesan or the kind of regional developments. But I can speak a little bit to what's going on in terms of the way evangelicals think about Catholics. So during this period, and this is transatlantic, this happens in New Orleans as much as it happens in Glasgow. There's this, you know, this kind of this fear amongst Protestants, especially amongst middle-class Protestants, that the Catholic, especially the Irish Catholic, represent both a religious and a kind of socio-ethnic threat to the homogeneity of a kind of Protestant state. So there's that kind of undergirding all that happens during this period. One thing that I found in my research is that a number of the evangelicals that I talk about were at least casually participants in anti-Catholic societies, like the Scottish Reformation Society and things of this nature. So societies that are established to evangelize in Roman Catholic neighborhoods, but also established to kind of polemically rebut Catholic doctrine and Catholic ideas. So there's less kind of on the ground sectarianism, but a lot more ideological and kind of print culture, kind of debate and kind of conflict going on between Presbyterian evangelicals and Roman Catholics during this period, especially in places like Glasgow, Cookbridge, Motherwell, places with a heavy Irish Catholic population.
Any more questions from the floor? Okay, I'll go back to the couple of questions I still have on my sheet. Oh, this is from you, a bit more near your neck of the woods, Andrew, from Donald Simpson from Burlington in Vermont. I know that's, it's, at least it's a little bit closer from you than Scotland. Okay, and he says, I remember hearing someone say that an evangelical Christian was anyone who likes Billy Graham. But what are your thoughts on evangelical Christians today? Do you see a distinction between fundamentalism, revivalism, and evangelicalism?
It's a great question. And that's a famous quote, right? An evangelical is anybody who likes Billy Graham. So I've laid out kind of the Bevington definition, the Bevington idea that evangelical is a conversionist, activist, Christus centrist, biblicist. In my book, I don't just take that face value. I actually do, you know, my research my research confirms that, but also shows distinctions in terms of what's happening within the Church of Scotland evangelicals in this period. So moving into the 20th century, into the present, are evangelicalism, revivalism, and fundamentalism, are they different things? They can be, depending on how you understand evangelicalism. A kind of a broad tent understanding of evangelicalism could include fundamentalism and revivalism. Sometimes fundamentalism is opposed to revivalism. Some fundamentalist sects and strands and streams of thought see revivalism as overly emotional, as overly experiential, as dangerously kind of unwieldy. But some fundamentalist kind of traditions, especially Pentecostal fundamentalists, see revivalism as inherent to their experience, to their doctrine, to their ideas. So yes and no in some senses. Evangelicalism and fundamentalism experience something of a split depending on which historian you're reading, in the US at least, in and around the 1920s and 30s. When we have the fundamentalist modernist controversy, many evangelicals become fundamentalists, but there are other evangelicals who kind of reject the rejection of culture and maintain a more kind of culturally aware faith throughout the 20th century. Then with Billy Graham, famously or infamously, you see a kind of renewal of a cultural facing evangelicalism and an abandonment of the old fundamentalism. And that happens in the 1970s and becomes kind of the norm in the 1990s, at least in the American context. In Scotland, it's a bit different, and there's a lot more complexity and nuance. Bevington and another scholar, whose name escapes me, actually wrote a collected book about fundamentalism in Britain and Scotland that kind of talked about the ways in which the British experience, including Scotland, Wales, and England, in terms of this divide between fundamentalism and evangelicalism, was not nearly as pronounced in terms of rejection of things. One example is science. Many evangelicals in America were extraordinarily off-put by Darwinian evolution, and that was a big touchstone in fundamentalism. Due to various factors, British evangelicals, including Scottish evangelicals, didn't really have a problem with evolutionary theory as long as it was understood theistically. So there was never really a scientific kind of battle between faith and science in Britain as much as there was in the US. And that's one of the key features of fundamentalism.
Oh, very interesting. Well, thank you very much. This is a question for me. So you mentioned William Muir, Norman MacLeod, and Charteris. What were their thoughts on patronage, because that was originally what caused the disruption. So were they okay with that, or just prepared to tolerate it, or what?
They were okay with it and prepared to tolerate it. They differed in their views. So Muir is interesting. So one of the things I argue is that Muir basically saw patronage as a tool to actually promote evangelicalism. So after the disruption, a lot of the pulpits, a lot of the parishes were empty because the ministers had left to join the Free Church. So Muir, who is kind of connected, well-connected to a lot of the kind of aristocracy and a lot of kind of movers and shakers in British politics, he had the ear of a lot of the patrons. And it was through his influence that a number of patrons actually replaced the ministers who left with other evangelicals who would go on to become established evangelicals in the national church. So Muir actually saw patronage, I argue, as a way to maintain and perpetuate gospel preaching in the established church. Norman MacLeod was of a different mind. MacLeod actually viewed patronage as something that was kind of a stain on the church, especially after disruption. And part of that has to do with MacLeod's ecumenicity. He was very broad-minded, and he wanted eventually to have a reunion with the Free Church. And he saw patronage as being an obstacle to that eventual reunion. So MacLeod over time kind of campaigned against abolition, or against patronage. And patronage was in the 1870s eventually abolished as a practice in the established church. So there was a kind of a diversity of opinion, but during the actual event, none of them saw it as, you know, clearly none of them saw it as being important enough to validate a secession.
Do we have any other questions? And in the information that you sent me earlier on, Andrew, you mentioned you might be planning to give a presentation on the impact of Moody and Sankey's Scottish revival. It's my understanding that these are the fellows that came across from the States and introduced music to the church. Maybe you could tell us about that pair that came across.
Sure. And so the men were named Dwight Moody and Ira Sankey. Dwight Moody did the preaching, and Ira Moody played a harmonium, kind of a little handheld organ, and sang kind of evocative, emotional gospel songs. And this, in parts of Scotland during this period, 1873 and 74, was actually quite radical, because many churches still only had sung psalms, you know, psalms with a presenter in the front, similar to the things we see today in Lewis and Skye with the Free Church and the Free Church continuing. So the liturgical revolution, the gradual introduction of music into Scottish churches, was very much kind of speeded along thanks to Moody and Sankey's revival movements, because Moody and Sankey led movements, led revivals, led crusades in kind of 20th century American language all over Edinburgh in, you know, I think 10 or 20 churches, and the same thing in Glasgow. So they really did catalyze the continued liturgical revolution that eventually led to music being the norm in most Scottish Presbyterian churches.
Well, thank you, Andrew. We have now come to the end of our session today. But before we go, I have a couple of comments received via the Zoom chat option. The first of these comes from Teresa Mackay, and she says, "Thank you, Dr. Jones, for your informative talk. I have recommended your book to the Scottish collection at the University of Victoria, More in Time." And the second message comes from Ewan Kennedy, and he says, "With regard to class, I've always been fascinated at the involvement of the Eton-educated Earl of Breadalbin, who financed a ship of that name to take Free Church ministers out to the islands." And so, to all of you who joined us today from all over the world on Zoom, thank you for your company and for your interest in our series of talks. And to Andrew, thank you for such a wonderful and erudite presentation.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for your wonderful questions. It's lovely after being away from Scotland for 5 years to hear a lovely Scottish accent. So thank you all for joining.
Okay, thank you very much. Have a lovely day. Bye-bye.